You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
The passage this morning is from Matthew chapter 5, verses 3 to 12, also known as the Beatitudes from the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
All right. Good morning, everybody. So I just have to warn you that there's the word tweak in my sermon. And I was practicing last night, and I said twerk, which is an inappropriate dance made famous by Miley Cyrus. So if I say that, go ahead and laugh at me. It's okay. So we've got the PowerPoint. Do not do this. Okay, they got it right. Do not do this. This should be interesting. So yes, my name is Todd Elwood. And for those who don't know me, I'll get into some biographical information in just a little bit. But before I do, I'm going to answer the question that certainly sits silently upon your hearts this morning. What am I doing up here? It's a logical question, and the answer is as simple as it is sincere. And the thing that qualifies me to be standing up here this morning is that I have an inability to say no to David Felton. That's it. That's the only reason I'm here. It could be you up here. It doesn't matter. If you can't say no to the guy, you might find yourself up here. I've orated exactly zero sermons in my entire life, and the odds are pretty heavy this will be my one and only shot at it, so soak it in, my friends. But along with my inability to say no to David Felton, I possess one other possible, if tangential, skill that might help us all as we navigate these choppy waters this morning. And it's a skill that relates back to the biography that I foreshadowed in my very first sentence this morning. I'm a man of average talent, for the most part, with the exception of two areas at which I consider myself an expert. The first being wooing Mia. There she is right there. Did you know you were going to be in the sermon this morning? So Mia is a girl I fell for long ago, and she's a girl I fall for over and over again. And wooing her is something I enjoy, and it's something at which I've become fairly skilled, if I do say so myself. Mia and I have been joined in holy matrimony for nearly 21 years, and together we are the parents of two teenage sons. So naturally, the wooing does not happen as often as we'd like it to. But just yesterday, we shipped our boys to Nebraska for 10 days. So meaning it's just me and her for 10 days. And let the wooing begin. So the second area at which I consider myself an expert is in wordsmithing, and that is to say writing and editing. This is what I do. And now here's where some serious biographical information comes in, so if you're taking notes, this is the time. I began delivering newspapers when I was in second grade. It was the York News Times in Little York, Nebraska. And I will paint you a Rockwellian portrait of my hometown in a little bit. Back then, for 6 days a week, I would sit in the basement of our house, and I would fold newspapers and then go deliver them to the porches in my neighborhood. Well, somewhere along that time, I began reading the newspaper, if you can imagine something these days. And I became enamored with a humorist by the name of Louis Grizzard Jr. So 3 times a week, I would read Louis's humor column, and by the age of 10, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with my life. I wanted to be a humor columnist. And that's the path that I carved, and I actually followed it. And for years, it worked out pretty well. That is, until the economy took a nosedive in 2008, and so did the newspaper industry. But that is a different sermon altogether. I considered myself an expert at wordsmithing, not only because of the 20-ish years that I wrote for publications, but mostly because in that time I was blessed enough to find mentors who taught me that writing and editing is no different than any other craft. It's nearly the same as wood carving, actually. You must actively learn how it's done, and you must practice, practice, practice at it. You also must learn to be ruthless at it, and that is chisel it and sand it until it meets your satisfaction. And sometimes you have to know when to just pitch the thing in the fire and start all over again. As part of learning the craft of wordsmithing, I began to keenly recognize and understand how other people use the language, and in some cases, how others manipulate the language. For example, when a politician lands in hot water, do we have any politicians in the house this morning? When a politician lands in hot water, I can almost immediately predict how his apology, will be massaged in such a way that he removes himself from personal responsibility by 1 or 2 degrees. And the first time I wrote this paragraph, by the way, I kept saying he or she, but then I looked at history to be my guide. It's mostly he. So I found some actual examples of apologies from politicians. I'm sorry if my actions caused harm. As though, I'm not responsible. My actions got out and they caused harm. Mistakes were made. By whom? Who's the subject there? We don't know. And then there's that one. I don't even have to comment about that one, do I? But politicians are not alone by any stretch. For example, when a TV journalist says, the cause of the fire is unknown, it means the reporter doing the story is missing the information, because the odds are very good someone does know the cause of the fire. Police officers will sometimes tell us that their detectives recovered a weapon used in a crime. Recovered technically means that the police at one point were in possession of the weapon and are now in possession of it again. What they mean to say is they found a gun. But recovered a weapon sounds more policey than found a gun. Even men and women of the cloth, if you can imagine, are not immune to tweaking their communication. I'm not going to spill too many beans, but when you hear the phrase prayerfully consider in church, get ready to break out your wallet, because it's usually a stewardship drive. Tweaking the language is not necessarily a bad thing, though. It's something I practice all the time, and it's something I think you should practice too. For example, when you're at a cocktail party, notice the conversations. When I'm meeting another man at a cocktail party, the first question usually is, so what do you do, Todd? And this is akin to dogs sniffing each other in the tail end, because we like to establish the pecking order, where we are in the pack, right? So if one guy says, well, I'm a garbage man, and the other guy says, oh, I'm a brain surgeon, the odds are very good that these guys are not going to be fishing buddies. But after the what do you do line is established, a follow-up is usually, where are you from? Well, you already know that I'm from a little town in Nebraska called York. And if I were asked, where are you from, that's probably my answer. But notice a little tweak to the question and see what happens. Where do you call home? Instead of where are you from, where do you call home? With that one adjustment to what essentially is the same question, My mind is going to reach back and find thousands of details. The word home does that. Instead of York, Nebraska, suddenly I'll want to tell you about the two-acre yard we had and how my older brother Mike and I had to mow the yard every weekend on our red snapper riding mowers. And I'll tell you about the four apple trees that lined the front of our property and how in the late summer, the four apple trees would just drop all their apples, seemingly in 2 weeks' time. And how my dad told us before we mowed that we were supposed to pick up the apples. Well, we rarely did that. We almost never did that. So we would ride our mowers right over the top of them, tong, 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 until the air was just thick with the smell of cider and cut grass. And in the bags of our mowers, it was just this mess of red, sticky, green, chewed up apples and grass. That's the difference between where are you from and where do you call home. That's the value of a tiny tweak to the language. And that's what paying attention to the language and making those small adjustments can do. But what does any of this have to do with God and religion? Did you ever think I would get to it? As someone who pays attention to how the language is used, I am fascinated with the stark contrast between the words of God in the Old Testament and the words of Jesus in the New Testament, especially in the Synoptic Gospels. I can't quite figure out Old Testament God and why he talks the way he does, and here's why. First, he's almost extremely specific when he's laying out the rules. And second, he very often uses something called negative suggestion. Negative suggestion is used by hypnotists quite a bit, and it's used when the hypnotist is trying to influence the way that you think and the way that you act. The classic example of a negative suggestion is, don't think of an elephant. What are you all thinking about right now? But for some reason, the words of God in the Old Testament are filled with very specific negative suggestions, especially when talking to us humans. From Genesis chapter 2, God tells Adam, you are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. For when you eat from it, you will certainly die. So here's a quick video I'm going to show you of one of my favorite hypnotists. His name is Darren Brown. And here he sums up negative suggestion perfectly.
Tonight, Lauren's going to experience an extreme example of something called negative suggestion. Throughout life, we are surrounded by negative suggestions, and these start early in our childhood when we're told don't do this and don't do that. The point is, the more we try not to do something, the more likely we are to give in and do it. Children are particularly prone to negative suggestion, and to show you this idea in its simplest form, I made a box that has a big red button on the front. We set the box up in a classroom we'd rigged with hidden cameras, brought in some midgety things to help out, and told them not to touch it.
You've got to guard this. It's a box with a surprise in. Okay? Will you guard it for me? Don't look inside the box. Don't open it.
So my negative suggestion there, don't look inside the box, is designed to sit heavily on their minds and stoke their curiosity.
We can't look in it. Don't press that little button. You touch it and it will open.
The idea goes round and around in their heads, and the more they try not to open it, the more difficult it is to resist.
Oh, a hand came out, right.
It was a
right,
physical so hand.
Right.
And I was so scared.
And it hit me. And it opened the box.
This rebellious urge to fight commands telling us not to do something is founded early in life and can carry on over into adulthood. Curiosity plays a role too. We wonder what will happen if we do the thing we're trying not to do and tend to give in because that childlike naughty urge won't go away. Curiosity can indeed kill the cat. Lauren's trick-or-treat is about to put this notion to the test in
so
the
I'm
most
not sure what
extreme
happened at the end
possible.
Of the video. Darren Brown is kind of scaringly talented at hypnosis, so it's probably some wicked combination of pattern interruption and rapid induction that happened just there. He's fine. He'll be up in a couple seconds. But back to our story. God tells Adam and Eve that they can eat from any tree, but don't eat from that one. And we all know what happened. They behaved just like the kids in the video. So what is our punishment for our human nature? God curses man to be a farmer. And women got the worst of the punishment. God said, quote, "I will make your pains in childbirthing very severe." Look it up. That's what he said. So life went on, and mankind continued behaving badly. We're only in humanity generation 2 when Cain kills Abel. Things go so badly, in fact, that God hits Control-Alt-Delete on the earth, except for 7 of each animal and Noah and his family. But after the flood, notice what happens. God says to himself that he will never again destroy all living creatures. In fact, he waxes poetically. As long as the earth endures and seed time and harvest, cold and heat, day and night will never cease. God gives Noah and his family the entire earth. All plants and animals are now on the menu. Where before, if you remember, we were only supposed to eat the plants. So the buffet is now open. But then, as if God cannot help himself, he says, "But you must not eat meat that has lifeblood still in it." It's another negative suggestion, and another specific one. Can't you imagine Noah thinking, meat with lifeblood in it? Fire up the Barbie, right? It happens over and over. Think of Deuteronomy and Numbers. In Leviticus alone, there are over 75 laws, most of which are very specific negative suggestions. Like, don't wear your hair this way. Don't grow your beard this long. One law says, do not drink wine on holy ground. And I know it's Sunday morning, but thinking about that law, I suddenly crave a nice glass of Pinot. Even the Ten Commandments are negative suggestions. In both Exodus and Deuteronomy, a full 8 of the 10 commandments are thou shalt not. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. Well, I hadn't thought of Mrs. Miller in that way, but now that you mention it. So knowing that human nature is that we almost instantly want to do what is specifically forbidden, what is the answer? Well, for me, it's thank God for Jesus. Can I get an amen? Jesus comes along and begins a ministry of positivity and beautiful vagueness. I'll repeat that. Positivity and beautiful vagueness. It's no accident that Jesus also is a master communicator. You talk about your expert wordsmiths. Jesus is unmatched. He used similes and metaphors and analogies. He foreshadowed, he echoed the classics. His sarcasm was a thing of beauty, often poking the Pharisees with sharp verbal barbs without them even knowing it. He was a mesmerizing storyteller, and he even used a poetic device called chiastic structuring. It's true. And just for fun last night, I've never used chiastic structuring before. So this is my idea of fun. I decided to try it myself. Chiastic structuring, if you don't know, is a lyrical device that mirrors what you're writing. So the pattern is A, B, C, C, B, A. So you start and end at the same place. It repeats itself. But even though you start and land on A is never the same when you get back to it. So here's my example of it. It's called Cold Rain, and I'll step when I make my ABCs. A cold rain fell. The boy was sad. He watched as the drops landed upon the rose petals. So he clipped a flower and gave it to the pretty girl. She smiled, he smiled. They happily danced for 65 years. He smiled, She smiled her final smile. So he clipped a flower and gave it to the pretty girl. And he watched as the drops landed upon the rose petals. The boy was sad, and a cold rain fell. That's chiastic structuring. Jesus did that. Jesus used chiastic structuring and all the other linguistic devices that I talked about, but if you think about it, so many of the great lessons that Jesus taught us, he forces you and me to reach the conclusion on our own. In fact, he challenges us to reach better conclusions because just at the right time, he was so beautifully vague. Blessed are the peacemakers, he said. That was from our reading today. Well, what does that make you wonder? What is a peacemaker? Am I a peacemaker? How can I become a peacemaker? How can I make peace? How can I make peace? Think about that. From his beautifully vague sentence, you end up with, how can I make peace? That's pretty important. Or take almost any of Jesus' parables. He rarely said, and the moral to the story is. In perhaps his most well-known parable of the prodigal son, Jesus literally says no words about its meaning. The story ends with the father explaining to the faithful son why they should celebrate the lost son's return. The father says, we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. That's it. That's how it ends. It's gorgeous, gorgeous positivity and vagueness. Jesus takes the 8 thou shalt nots and in one swoop turns them all to positive while remaining vague. He said, love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And love your neighbor as yourself. And for me, that is the great lesson. So you remember earlier when I said, when I talked about tweaking your own words for a better result, that's exactly what Jesus did with his father's instructions. When we love God with everything we have, when we love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, perhaps part of that is taking his words and challenging ourselves to tweak them for a better outcome, maybe even for a joyful result. So in my case, I'll take, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, and instead of trying not to think about Mrs. Miller, I'll challenge myself to come up with a tweak, even if it's a vague one, to arrive at a positive outcome. So instead of thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, how about thou shalt woo thy beautiful bride? Amen.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information on our faith community, or to support this outreach with a donation, be sure to visit us online at www.reachtouchteach.com.